Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Beta.
Mythos.
Mythos, would you like to do the introduction to the show?
No.
Dan is thwarted.
So instead, Beta, would you like to do the introduction to the show?
Today's session includes Dan Quick.
Hey, everyone.
Makalua.
24 hours into Fallout New Vegas, and I'm still not to New Vegas.
Mythos.
Greetings, everyone.
Lisa.
Hi.
Philip.
I'm taking your cities. It looks so pretty.
And I'm Beta.
Archers can take cities in Civ 5. I was kind of like, wow, this threat is this young? Yeah, you can. I was kind of surprised to see that it was a surprise to some people, but I think it's just because they didn't even try. As it says, you get them down to where there's no more damage that can be done, the unit is gone, and then you simply hit the move button. And they will move into a city, or they'll move into a barbarian camp, and away you go.
Personally, I think it's more of an insult to take it with scouts, but that's just me.
Your civ is so weak, I scouted it.
Puts a whole new meaning on being scouted, yes.
Easy Money in here says that this needs to be fixed right away. Design intent was that range units couldn't capture cities, and also, because land range units defend at the range combat strength when bombarded, making them extremely difficult to destroy if you don't have a melee unit nearby. Well, I'd be more concerned if there actually wasn't a particular counter to that, so there, you should have a melee unit nearby.
Yeah. Plus, people don't generally lead with their archers.
You can capture it, but it's going to take you, like, 4, 5, 6 turns anyway. So, assuming that unit's at full strength, as it usually is. So I don't know, if you actually, for instance, let your city get taken that way, you're not doing something right.
Yeah.
Or you got really screwed over, or a combination of the two.
It's kind of like getting killed by the piston in an Unreal Tournament. It's just, yeah, it's humiliating.
I can't relate, but I'll take your word for it.
Oh. Well, unlike Call of Duty, which has a knife as an instant kill, the piston is not necessarily an instant kill, and it's melee in a game with, like, ludicrously damaging weapons. So, dying to that, yeah, that's not good.
The English 101 for Civ Forum users. The thing I liked most about that thread was actually learning a new word. Prig, a person who displays or demands of others pointlessly precise conformity, fussiness about trivialities, or exaggerated propriety, especially in a self-righteous or irritating manner.
That one's new to me, too. Quite nice, quite nice. In the Senate, we discussed the benefits and drawbacks of deliberately delaying caste system, as well as the strengths of caste system itself, and catapult rushes, the timing for them, and the text to get them.
In Foreign Talk, we discussed how barbarian moves in Civ 5 are not that interesting. We also discussed in Civ 5, why bother annexing anything? Whether it's worth it to pay $5 for each civilization you're going to get.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Delayed caste system. This topic was started by Artichoker. He says that caste system is a pretty decent thing, although people say that it's worthless. Because we have the unlimited specialists, you can increase the size of your great people farms during the golden age, and that's what's so great about caste system. So he's basically bringing up the idea of delaying caste system until you have a golden age at the same time.
I find this is an interesting topic because it'll seem backwards to rookie players. It's hard to see the benefits of early caste system until you're pretty familiar with the game. The ability to get that many great people that early, especially if you can get the multipliers for it, philosophical or pacifism or national epic, you can usually at least get one of those, often two. You can just get a ridiculous amount of scientists early, and that's how the best players get liberalism before 500 AD, sometimes in the BCs, if conditions are favorable. The delayed caste system is a valid strategy, but first you have to take it in the context of why these people don't like delaying caste system. But, you know, anarchy does have an impact on your game, and probably an underestimated one as the game goes along. So if you can get something comparable out of slavery, or if delaying it doesn't hurt you as much depending on your strategy, say you're going for classical or medieval war, then delaying casteism is not as bad, because the other benefits of the civic don't arise until later.
My first exposure to the strategy is proposed, but having read it, I'm intrigued. I'd give it a go.
It just depends on when people usually end up getting civil service, because it might not be that early for that many people.
It's code of laws, by the way.
Yeah. Although you get it relatively early, but I don't really see a problem. I mean, people have this option to switch early if they want to, and a caste system is not accurate of a civic early on, but if you're not using whip very much, or you have higher happy cap already, then it'd be okay to switch to caste system early. Or if, you know, you're trying to keep your populations down by running specialists, you know, that would work too.
I don't know. I consistently find this to be the single hardest civic choice to make in Civ 4. More so than any other civic line is deciding between caste system and slavery in the early to mid game. Just because your tech potential with caste system is so much higher, but in some cases, your production potential, slavery, is better by enough that you'd prefer that instead. And you really need things like, if you have low hammers as base, you're going to have a hard time bringing out things like universities unless you're in slavery. But then, if you really want to get the high tech rate temporarily, you want caste system. So picking between the two is really a difficult strategic choice early in the game, and it's part of the reason that spiritual is a little bit stronger than beginning players think.
Yes, because they're being spiritual, allowing you to switch civics without the turn or more of anarchy, usually one or two. Unlimited artists, scientists, and merchants, plus one hammer from workshops. And then, of course, slavery at bronze working, where you can sacrifice population to finish production in a city. I don't use caste system anywhere near as much as I should. I stay in slavery far too long, and usually by the time I'm out of slavery, it's when I'm forced to it because of happiness, because people are adopting emancipation. Arg. Although, it really is kind of getting me to, especially with emancipation of plus 100% growth for cottage, hamlet, village, by that point in the game, it's kind of the kick in the pants to me that, you know, you should have done this already, Dan, but I guess if it takes the happiness thing, and then it ends up being better for you later on, but early to mid-game caste system, maybe I accidentally choose it when I'm trying to switch to another civic, and then this is actually a good idea. But I always forget.
I'll switch the caste system within, like, 10 turns of getting it.
To be honest, I don't use it online a lot when I'm playing with you guys, just because it's like, I almost always am spamming units, so I just stay in slavery. But, you know, if I'm actually trying to attack rapidly, I'll frequently switch into it. If you watch the high-level deity games, they'll use it quite a bit, depending on the situation they're in. Like Unconquered Sun or something, or Rustin. Any of the guys who've done, like, detailed deity walkthroughs, they'll show you right when they switched in the caste system and why.
Catapult rushes. Vicka-woo! Did I choose this topic just to be able to say that? Time will tell. Talks about the catapult rushes have somewhat gone out of style since Warlords, but catapults, elephants are still a reliable way to win the continent, and of course also mentions Axe Chariot Rush, Horse Archer Rush, Rapid Expansion, and we've talked about all of those before. So he says he usually transitions into construction as quickly as possible. He mentioned specifically catapult and elephant rushes, but almost anything combined with catapults can also be a reliable way to win the continent, although I will say that I don't equate that to an Axe Chariot Rush or a Horse Archer Rush, just in terms of timing in the game. Yes, I'm going for construction reasonably soon, but my first war, for instance, is typically not going to involve catapults unless there just happens to be too much freaking distance between myself and the next civ, and by the time that becomes viable, I'm actually that far along in the technology tree. But I think that also that you can, again, pair catapults with almost any decent offensive unit and use them. But I guess I don't consider it so much of a rush with catapults, simply because there then needs to be that companion unit that can actually go in and take those cities.
But then there's the counter, which is that city you're attacking has 8 catapults in there, and it bombards your stack. You're in enemy territory, and of course all your main attack units are now wounded, so what do you do?
Die, because defenders have a big advantage in Civ 4.
If you have catapults and they do not, okay.
Okay, exactly, but...
Or if they happen to have their catapults elsewhere in their empire and they can't get back to you soon enough.
Right.
Okay.
That's okay. That's when you make two stacks of horse archers and just fork the cities, because anybody competent enough to attack you with eight catapults out of their city is probably not an AI, so you just have to use multiplayer tactics at that point. Elephants are a very special case when it comes to catapults. They have much higher base strength than the other ancient and classical units, and their only weakness is to spear, you know, obviously pikes later on, that kind of thing. Those things fight them equally. I mean, they win hammer for hammer, but they also don't do so well against catapults. So just the elephants in catapults, unlike a lot of other compositions, is pretty strong. Now, you take other units, like, say, axes, you'll have 50-50 with enemy axes. You'll actually be a little bit weaker with your catapults than enemy axes, so they can clean you up with that. If you don't have enough spears and you're not using elephants, then horse archers can just completely maul your incoming stack, and very cost-effectively as well. So you really need some balance in your stack if you don't have the elephants. Now, if you do have the elephants and you throw in a couple axes to protect yourself from pikes, that's going to be viable until the AI starts throwing muskets around, which is a long, long time away, which is why elephants are kind of ridiculous in this game. They were never that strong historically compared to how they seem to be in video games. The hardest thing about a catapult rush is getting the combination of tech and production to do it in time, especially in high levels. When they start running into longbows with them, you'll lose so many.
Well stated.
Really depends on the start. Can get there a little bit faster with a great scientist in here. Use the Oracle for some help, which is what Vic'Wu did in his opening post. He actually settled on Marvel. Monarchy chain whipping, so your people to death unhappiness, but you get more cities than you turned into total useless centers, so that helps. It's a good thing there aren't barbarian elephants.
I wonder if they could if they had elephants.
Oh yeah, like in a barbarian city. I don't ever remember seeing a barbarian elephant, even in sometimes where I've seen a barbarian city actually have elephant and have that tile improved.
They can produce things like chariots and elephants. There's only like a set thing at number of units they can actually produce or spawn.
Elephants know better than to take up with barbarians.
Yeah.
Back to the point about them being overstrength relative to any historical context. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And that would have been easy to take care of just by keeping the multiplier against mounted units, which there is some historical context for, and paring back the strength a bit.
Yeah.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Especially since we're trying to combine Civ 4 and Civ 5 discussion, this just seems to be a perfect segue into a Civ 5 topic that also has alliteration going for it, very much so. Which is that barbarians are boring, says High Seas Pirate.
Great topic, great topic. High Seas Pirate says, barbarians presented a challenge in Civ 4 from time to time, especially if you use the Raging Barbarians. In Civ 5, they are boring to me. I've played several games and never lost a unit to a barb. Never once have I seen any barbs take over any city from anyone. I liked how in Civ 4 you really had to protect your cities, surrounding countryside, and defenseless units from them. In Civ 5, big deal. They don't seem to do anything but allow you to gain experience points for units or conquer camp for a measly 37 gold. Goes on to say that barb ships are completely useless too. I've destroyed hundreds of them and they never fight back, ever. Please fix the barbarians.
Okay, this is one of those times where I'm going to call somebody out for being a loving Civ 4 so much that he's guilty of they change it, it sucks in Civ 5. Civ 4 barbarians were a bad mechanic, I am sorry. When you had the ability to completely lock out barbarians on deity using warriors to defeat barbarian galleys by having them never spawn using mostly land units and maybe a workboat, you consider that a good barb model, and then if the random number generator bounced the wrong way, you could have your game just hosed by them on, like, say, a huge map, to the point where if you got a couple unlucky runs against barbs early in the game, it could set you back, like, 20, 30 turns in long term just because that happened. Come on now. That's fake difficulty. That's not fun gameplay. They actually did something good with barbarians in Civ 5, and man, people are criticizing them for it. Also, this guy is not particularly accurate when it comes to barbs being a threat in Civ 5 either. There is an achievement you can get for having the barbs capture your city. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, but it's something that's there. But they can also delay your ability to build tile improvements. They can pillage and destroy your tile improvements. At least force you to be a little bit cautious with your units when you're outside of your borders. And there's some active reward for going out and killing them, but it's not so ridiculous as to be getting another city for it. I find the mechanic a lot better now than it was before, personally. Like, you still have to have some semblance of defense or it's going to set you back. But, you know, a little bit of a random number generator screw from the barbarians isn't going to be game-changing to you. And I think that's a good balance to have for barbarians. Although I think there is a Raging Barb setting in Civ 5.
There is.
So if you turn that on, I'm sure that there'll at least be a nuisance, and you can have all the fun fighting non-Civ that you could possibly love.
We had this discussion in CFC Hall of Fame of, in Civ 4, we had no problem allowing disable it, because they didn't really matter. But in Civ 5, barbs are such a big part of the game. It's like, we actually were discussing it.
Not allowing them to be disabled?
Yeah.
I'm not sure you want to do that, just because it might be disadvantageous to disable them.
Well, yeah, you disable them, and then you pick the Civs who have traits related to them, and it kind of makes it easier, but still, the game just seems to be built more around them.
You're not going to get away from that in Hall of Fame. You are never going to get away from that in Hall of Fame. Picking settings to make the goal easier. Oh my god, just the ability to pick which civilizations you're against is just... Oh. Now, that doesn't mean you'll be able to beat other good players, but you at least should be able to win the games pretty easily.
One of the posters in this thread, Baloma Clone, if I got the name right, says, I'd like to see a barbarian uprising that is able to take over cities and become a civ in its own right. It'd be the most realistic. And I kind of thought that was an interesting idea. Again, it might be really unbalancing, as similar to the uprising in Civ 4, if you happen to be the poor civilization next to the uprising when it occurred.
Yeah, the Vedagarians can show up outside that guy's house. I'm done with those, personally.
Yeah.
With barbarians, they give you an added incentive in addition to finding out where the city-states are, where their civilizations are, where it is that you want to settle, happiness, resources, food, and all that, to go out and actually conquer those camps for the experience and for the gold. But it also gets you to pause for a moment to send out unescorted settlers and workers, help keep your quote-unquote uncontrolled expansion potential, especially if there's nobody else around you. And true, they are quote-unquote isolated in the camps, at least to start, but then, of course, they will come out. And so because of that, it's just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah. Especially once you've got the honor social policy. Oh, I know where they are, so I'll just be certain to avoid that area. I mean, they can come out of nowhere. Maybe their intelligence in terms of whether or not they're going to attack you or not isn't the greatest. But he actually criticized the barbarians on the water and blockading them. I've had a couple of games where I really didn't have any reason to go onto the water at that point, usually because I'm playing Pangaea. Get rid of those darn things because they go and they blockade me.
Yes, I had to build a Terminus once just because the barb galleys kept coming around, keep them out of the way to protect my cities. That was kind of nice.
Or if you're hugging also the coastline with a unit to have, like, barbarian galley attack you and, you know, some of your hit points off, and it's like, oh my gosh, please stop doing that. I need to go out and get rid of you because you're just going to be a nuisance.
And it's nice that they did the whole city-state barb camp thing to kind of also make the barbs a little bit more worth it. You know, the city said, hey, I need help. Come wipe out this camp. Of course, it always does a whole thing where you see a camp next to a barb city, so you just kind of move away and wait till they call for your help.
Yeah, unless the AI takes it out first. You don't have to watch for that.
So, barbarians aren't boring.
No, they're different, and as Fel was getting to the fact that they're different from the ones in Civ 4, these are good things.
I agree with the original statement. This guy is too much into the whole Civ 4, Civ 5's different thing, and he can't move on.
Why bother annexing anything? Oh, great. Of course, it has a difficult to pronounce poster name. Okay, this was post was started by Zeknichov. I think I got that right. If I did not, I apologize.
Or Zeknikov.
Zeknikov. Okay, I'll say it both ways, and then if you know if one or the other is right, there you go.
You were both right and wrong at the same time.
Listeners, you can self-edit that. Whichever way I said it that was correct, yeah, just go with that one.
Unless it's both wrong, in which case... ignore that whole explanation. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Wants to know why bother annexing anything, especially puppets, focus, gold. Just build 1 to 5 main cities and puppet everything else. Your happiness and culture benefits more than annexing. He almost doesn't see the point of annexing. He says, well, it may not be a problem. He just doesn't see the basically the strategic benefit in annexing. The dominant strategy in Civ 5 versus alternative strategies. There really isn't much disincentive, other than some social policies, to just spamming cities and getting huge as soon as you can, or it's usually more cost-effective and happiness-effective to just take a bunch of puppet cities constantly. even before the patch, if you gave Puppets lots of trading posts or whatever, they would not have built too many expensive buildings. So they would essentially become gold factories for you anyway. This just makes it a little bit more convenient, a little bit more control over the Puppets. But again, it doesn't change the fundamental issue that maybe that's just a little bit too strong. I don't have the answer there, but when it comes to annexing something, the only draw for that is control of the city. If you have good production in the city, you might want it, like, for, say, hammer out your courthouse quickly, and now you have a good wonder-producing city, or another unit-producing city. You can only buy so much, and the puppet cities won't necessarily produce the gold buildings that you want, especially if you tell them to just build gold. You're not going to get as much out of them as you would otherwise. But yeah, I would say the conquest thing is a little bit too strong relative to other strategies, and then it's really difficult to completely fill out the social policy trees or even get decently into them if you expand at all. So the balance between that and going for culture is just a little off kilter, in my opinion. I would like to see some balance between your options in this game, rather than everybody just paying off maritime civs and conquering as soon as they possibly can, as much as they possibly can, and abusing trades.
His thread is titled, "Why Bother Annexing Anything?" So it makes it sound like he's totally against it, but yet then you actually read in his post where he says, "I almost don't see the point." It's like, okay, it didn't quite fit with what your thread title is. But like him, I'll puppet anything unless it's like capital or something where I really, really prefer having control of the city.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting that his subject or his statements don't quite agree with the title he chose.
If you get really huge, you're going to want the happiness structures, but you're not going to have the ability to tell the puppets to build them. So eventually you might need to start annexing them just to finish the courthouse and then quickly get other happiness structures so you can do anything at all. So there's that as well. That could be a problem. Because ultimately you can get more happiness from an annexed city than you would from a puppet city dedicated to gold. Takes longer, but once you get the Colosseum Theater in there, it's almost guaranteed that that's producing more happiness than you're losing out on annexing.
Courthouses need to be either can buy them or something, because it takes too long to build the stupid things in an annexed town.
Yeah, you really need a good hammer city to build them in a reasonable time, unfortunately.
And I realize they're trying to make it so it's a little bit more difficult on you, but it's a little bit too much now.
Yeah. Well, I think the conquest approach in general is too strong. People are just using puppets instead, whatever. You could look at some balance between annexing and puppeting, but I think the big priority right now is just doing something about the returns or just rushing everybody ASAP, other than city-states. You just kill all the AIs that you can reach.
Martino Guy argues in here, he brings up, it's not just a question of annex or even puppeting. Of course, your other choice is, of course, raise. And he argues that your best bet is to do just that and then resettle, just to get around the obscene and extortion-like cost of maintaining an annexed city. I don't necessarily think that's the case. In part, it depends back to like the production capability also when you're trying to decide, for instance, whether you're just going to leave it as a puppet or you're going to annex. What's the point, for instance, of raising a city that's not going to have very good production and then just turn around and settle it yourself that's also not going to have very good production?
Well, if you have a maritime city-state that gives you food every turn, because if you annex that, it's never going to be able to build anything. Even that courthouse is going to take forever. So it's going to be a happiness drain right away. Whereas if you settle it, it's going to grow pretty quickly. Then it'll be workable from that standpoint. Like, you won't have to deal with the unhappiness. Essentially, you're outsourcing the courthouse costs to another city, plus you don't have to eat the maintenance for the courthouse for the rest of the game. So there is some benefit from that standpoint. The reason you would annex a city is if it has a lot of good buildings in it already, or it has a lot of culture, or it has enough production to actually build the courthouse sometime this year.
Okay, yeah, so there's particular circumstances where that would be beneficial, but he's just like, your best bet, like just kind of a general approach to raise, and resettle.
Yeah, sure, I'll raise a city that has like 5 wonders in it, because it's cheaper to resettle.
Plus, it's nice, too, that you actually keep the culture.
Yes.
I like that feature.
And that has some potential strategic value, too, if you're going to continue a war and you're looking at moving from the city you just captured onto another city. If you raise it, the culture from the other city could start becoming a little bit of a problem.
Some people are whining or all, oh, they don't sack my cities automatically. Boo.
Yeah, as if that was fun.
Yeah. DLC, the $5 civilization, are you down with it? $5 a civ. Well, this is just the first one. This is a testing to see if, are you going to pay this much for a civ or not?
somebody brings up a good point of, right now they're selling the Babylonian one, currently only available with the people who bought it earlier. But what I'm curious about is, after the Babylonian one, are they going to continue to do $5 a Civ, or is it just for the Babylonians? If it's for every Civ, then that's just too expensive. I don't think it's worth it.
Would you put a price value at where you would actually purchase it, where they're still charging?
$1.99, $9.99.
Technically, they lowered the price, right? Because you had to pay like $10 extra for the deluxe edition, and now you get the thingy for $5. I don't know, it's still stupid.
Well,
I just don't like the idea of them slowly selling more content, creating more content, when they haven't even necessarily fixed all the bugs that are in the original content.
Yes, that's my sticking point.
That has definitely come up in this thread, yes.
I'll explain my problem with it is the same situation we have now, where you have those who have the Babylonian version and those who don't, can't even play a succession game, let alone multiplayer. So what happens when they start adding civs? And so you have somebody who has Civ A and somebody has Civ B and somebody has Civ C. And eventually when they come out with play by email, hopefully, it's going to be a mess as to what civs you're playing with and what you're not.
You're diluting the versions of Civ.
Yeah, that's problematic.
And I like the way they've done it in the past with Civ 4, is I put out a release that brings a whole different set of options and aspects to the game, and then you include Civs in that. So you include 3 more Civs or a couple more leaders or a couple more city-states, something along those lines, rather than releasing individual Civs. That just doesn't cut it with me.
We're having the issues in our CFC Hall of Fame of trying to compete with equal games, but if one person has this additional Civ, the other groups, they don't have it available because they didn't pay for it, it makes it difficult to keep things somewhat equal. So it's going to be tough for competition games, succession games, stuff like that.
Especially since Babylon, in this case, just has so much tech potential compared to pretty much every other Civ. Yeah, I could see that being a problem, and a big one right now.
It's Bab to the bone.
Dan's so proud of you right now.
That was me clapping. That was great.
Like, seriously, there's nothing wrong with it in theory. I'm not sure if in practice it's a good method for Civ 5, but I mean, if you look at, like, say, the cost of an expansion versus the cost of all the content that could eventually add up to the equivalent of one, it could be done where you could release things over time and still have a good product, but the version compatibility is such a huge problem in this particular game that they really need to find a workaround for that, or it's not going to be viable.
Yeah, I think back to the Civ 4 days. I mean, we had to pick a specific date where everybody switched over to the new version to keep things like demo games going and succession games and all the play-by-email games. So I agree 100%. I mean, I think it's just heading for a nightmare if they don't come up with a more consistent approach.
You know what they could do, and it would be scary, but kind of silly at the same time, I guess, is allow the different versions to play each other, so you could wind up playing against Babylon even if you don't have access to the Civ yourself. That's going down a whole nother road that could make things even worse.
Yeah, especially when you get into games where buying downloadable content means, I know we had a discussion on this, I think, last season about some games where the more money you had, the more you were able to buy things and the better your position. And as Phil already mentioned, the tech advantages of Babylon, you could argue that if you allow that in a game where not necessarily everybody else has that, then you're kind of starting on the path towards that. And at the same time, is the answer then to exclude them? Or if you exclude them, then perhaps you have games where you insist that you have to have that civilization installed. When we talk about different versions and getting everyone up to speed, if you had a set date, you know, either you need to have this patch installed for a particular title, whether you've got the expansion or not, at least the patch, I mean, that was so that someone could download and it was free. There were enough issues you had between Vanilla Civ and Warlords and Beyond the Sword, and as I said before, now you're diluting it even more, but I think even beyond that issue becomes really the price point. I mean, part of the discussion here was also, is $5 a Civilization really worth it? And some people were saying, yes, it is, because when they looked at expansion packs like Beyond the Sword, they really looked at, oh, there's 10 new civilizations, and that's what made them want to pay the $20 or $30. But then there were other people that were like, oh, Beyond the Sword, look at this, espionage and corporations. That's what makes me want to get that particular expansion. But in the end, that also ties back to the different versions, because whatever got you to buy Beyond the Sword, whatever that combination was, you still got Beyond the Sword, so there was at least that base. But now, if you start essentially cherry-picking what downloadable content you're going to get and not going to get, and I think that'll be the case for most people, that there will be some downloadable content that they get, and others they don't get, not only because of the price point, which is up to debate, but also because of what that downloadable content is. Because is downloadable content only going to be civilizations? Could that also be maps? Scenarios?
Units?
What, no mention of the Apostolic Palace and Beyond the Sword Ban?
Oh, I might pay for that DLC.
Oh, I'd be so shocked.
Auto-win DLC.
Davor and this thread on the 2K forums talked about, you know, the market will bear what people are willing to pay for. That's certainly part of it. Some people, like Dax, are like, oh, $5 is such a small sum of money that it's barely worth contemplating. Well, let's just assume for a moment that $5 in and of itself is cheap. So this Civ costs $5, and then the next Civ costs $5. We don't have an idea of just how many, for instance, civilizations Firaxis is thinking of releasing and charging for, and what that price point is going to be. So some people are trying to figure out, you know, in the end, are we going to have a situation where we end up paying comparable amounts in the end once all the official stuff from Firaxis for Civilization V is complete? Is that going to be a comparable price as what we paid to Civilization IV? And are we going to get a comparable experience? But we also know that they're giving Mongolia away for free, and so some people have actually said, well, no, it kind of feels like if they're charging $5 for one and they're giving the other away for free, some people are saying, well, it's really like $2.50 for a Civ.
Hmm.
They've got to charge for Babylon just because of the fact that people paid the additional money when they bought it earlier.
Yes, and as Lisa pointed out, as of this recording, the game has barely been out a month, and all of a sudden, in the end, you paid $5 more essentially to have Babylon for a month.
You rented it for a month.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now is that...
Well, the upgrade to the Digital Deluxe or Deluxe Edition also included other stuff too, not just Babylon.
Yeah.
So we're getting for a cut rate just to get Babylon.
But I have a feeling most people really wanted the Babylon compared to the other stuff.
Yeah, it all gets back to what you value in terms of how much are you willing to pay for a certain something, and is that certain something really what you want?
I have the old forceability question going on here, too, as well, when it comes to DLC. Because I've seen mods that allow for Babylon to exist that are separate from the actual purchasing of the Deluxe Edition or whatever it is that gives you access to Babylon. And you say you're designing a Hall of Fame mod, would you necessarily have to use official content, or could you simply copy the strengths of those civs into a mod, such as Hall of Fame mod? So you have, like, Babylon. It's not official Babylon, but it plays precisely like Babylon in the mod. That might help out from your aspect.
Yeah, we're currently talking to Elizabeth about some of this stuff, because we're actually seeing some of this pop up where people have modded things very similar.
Yeah.
And I don't think the discussion with Elizabeth, I can't think of her last name.
Toby.
Yeah, I don't think the discussion has been completed yet, so I can't really answer that.
I see.
Yeah, so for our listeners, Elizabeth Toby, 2K Elizabeth, she is the community manager for all of 2K, and then Greg Labs is specifically, 2K Greg is specifically for the Civilization community.
Because there is certain legal issues.
Well, this question came up even before the game was released, when they knew there was going to be downloadable content, and Firaxis and 2K said you're going to have downloadable civs, and then there was also the ability, for instance, to mod the game, including civilizations, and have that in the mod browser so it was easier to get to, and the question became, if someone creates a Babylon mod, and there's an official one, and it's all supported through this in-game browser, which 2K and Firaxis has managed, would they actually allow that Babylon mod to continue, even if it was essentially the same thing as the official version, only it happened to be free? And so now we're actually confronted with that question, in practice, because it's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's not going to be worth it, then, to create or to have these civilizations, and if they're comparable to what's being paid for, I guess there was also the question, I'm not that familiar with, like, Civilization IV's modding community, was there a big push, for instance, to have available for free civilizations that came with Beyond the Sword, but these were available for free that people who did not purchase Beyond the Sword would actually be able to run. But I guess really the difference now is when you've got built-in browser, it's like Civ 4 in terms of modding, in terms of the free versus paid for, but it's also not the same because when you talk about the distribution of those mods.
Also, the additional Civs that were added in Civ 4 did not exist in a vacuum and came along with those other features, making it a little bit more difficult to actually mod all of that. I mean, maybe it was possible.
True.
But when you have Civ 5, I mean, you're just straight adding Civs. And that's never, at least historically, been something that you're not allowed to do. So I think this is a little bit of shaky waters now.
Firaxis and 2K are certainly keeping the lines of communication open. And I guess time will tell to what extent the voices are heard and how they decide what voices they're going to listen to. Because, of course, as with any large community, the Firaxis and 2K are going to ultimately have to make these decisions, and they're not going to be able to please everybody.
Also, Lisa touched on this, but when it comes to more content, right now, that's simply not a priority. I know the new patch came out. I know that addressed a lot of the problems with the game, but it did not come anywhere near to addressing all of the problems with the game. At least in my opinion, before I see new content coming out, I would like the gameplay mechanics to be solid. I don't want to have games ending early on bugs. I don't want to have only one or two viable strategies in the game because the balance between strategies, and I'm not even getting into the balance between civs, just the balance between strategic approaches in the game is off kilter and things like that. I would much rather see that addressed before I see a single another civ, but that's my preference. A lot of people are fine with the way things are now, and that's actually very frustrating to me.
And in addition to that consideration, if those issues aren't addressed, and now you're talking about also adding additional content, how you are implementing that additional content and that balance of that, if that's still within the framework of earlier versions, and then you're also trying to work on correcting the issues with the initial game, then what happens to that downloadable content when you did all of that testing during the time when you're also trying to fix the other issues that came upon release? Because there's a great potential there to not only have to address the initial issues of the release, but then once you address that, then it's okay, what did those changes from earlier on in the game, how did that impact the downloadable content that was developed before these other issues were addressed and before these other questions were answered?
Yeah.
There's actually a direct correlation, not only in terms of arguably the order that it should come in, but also the danger of trying to do both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I don't have a good answer there, but I know that it will not be kosher if they attempt to charge for fixing the game and not actually adding content, but simply making the features better.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Fallout New Vegas.
Has anyone of you guys played that? Because I'm really tempted.
Yes. It's a separate developer from Fallout 3, but they're known for making buggy things that have really good writing. So, the fact that there's bugs is not surprising, and I don't know why everyone's getting, you know, all, oh my god, it has bugs. Well, so does everything these days.
You don't know why they're getting their togas in a twist? Is that what
you're saying? Thank you. There we go. I want to go for something a little ruder, but yeah.
Hey, come on now. I do not see a lot of bugs in StarCraft 2. I am just saying.
Yes, but also, how long do they take to make StarCraft 2? Come on. Whereas everybody else is getting forced into shorter cycles and...
Hey.
Go blame the publishers, not the developers.
Maybe there's something to be said about that, though, you know?
Yeah, like, I, for one, am looking forward to Duke Nukem Forever, because that's going to be the most stable game ever released.
That's like the legend right there, the legend of Duke Nukem Forever.
I'll believe it when I actually see it on a store shelf.
I still remember the old text games. I love those games.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I played those.
Really? Of course, that was back when it came out on the 5 1/4-inch disc, but it was just a text. You just typed in north, south, or, you know, whatever. Those were the best.
Oh, I remember seeing my brother play those. I was a little bit too young to play those. You know, usually I don't have too many six-year-olds, that kind of thing, playing text-based games only.
He just called me old.
No.
He called us both old.
You could point out that I'm young instead. I think Lisa's the only one on the call that's actually younger than me, so, you know, it's not like I'm old.
I know.
Everything is relative.
Back to Civ.
Back to Civ.
Did you guys know that you could decide what the research agreement gives you?
Really? I did not know that.
if you put one turn of research into something, the game will bias against giving you that technology from your research agreement. Right when your research agreement's about to finish, just put one turn of research into each of the things that you don't want to get from the research agreement, and then you'll get the whatever it is that you didn't put any research into. Because it cycles priority, and the first priority is something that you've not researched at all. You could spam a bunch of research deals and have them finish and go into a sudden and really deep tech beeline just by having those as the only available text that you're not researching.
Person you're doing the agreement with, don't they have to be able to get that tech, though? I mean, if you do something too high.
No. The way it works is that you just get a random technology that's available to you when the research agreement completes.
Oh, so you can get different techs.
Actually, you want to make research agreements with the weaker and more backward civilizations because they get less value from the research agreement than you do. The more advanced you are, the more beneficial a research agreement is. Although they're usually worth it anyway. A couple hundred gold versus that many beakers. That's a pretty good conversion. It's hard to beat it.
Mathos, can we convince you to do the closing of the show?
Oh, wait. I think I lost you all.
That's
right.
Timing of that statement, the inflection in your voice, suggests that you are lying, sir.
Thank you for listening to Podcast Today with your host, Dan Q.
Now it's time for the quiz.
Mackie.
No, now it's time for me to go to the Vegas Strip and start, you know, busting the casinos, yeah.
Did she just say she's going to strip?
Las Vegas, New Vegas Strip. I go play Fallout.
That was the male brain translation of what Mackie just said.
This closing brought to you by the male brain.
The man team.
Be sure to join me after the show. I will show you my caste system.
Q&L.
I was.
Beta.
Goodbye and keep on serving.
And myself, Mythos. Thank you for listening and enjoy serving.
Since we're all out of order here in terms of who chooses the topic, let's stick with the ladies. Mackie?
More crickets.
We lost Dan briefly.
Yeah, I thought I'd lost myself briefly because of my recent internet troubles, but I guess it was just Dan.
Oh, am I back now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, we're just talking to you for the hell of it.
We're just pretending you're here, and you're just saying the correct things resulting in it, because we just know you that well. So it's like you're here, but you're really not. One thing I didn't see here that I really wish I did was the AI to stop rage quitting and giving away, like, six cities and peace deals. Because that leads to runaway situations really quickly on high levels, and it's stupid.
Hello? I'm at home. Out at the store. I'm doing a podcast on the internet, so I'm kind of busy.
So, what'd I miss?
Oh, you missed where we ripped Max a new one? And
Max or Mackie?
Hey, hey.
Wow, that...
Well, now this is just getting ugly.
You can do multiplayer?
Well, you can. It's a little painful.
Q&L. Was he here today?
I was.
He?
And
oh, okay. Sorry.
Q&L, now with 100% less female parts.
100% more testosterone. Good times.
Just reach through the internet and choke him.
I won't hold it against you, Mathos, much. I mean, not at all. What am I talking about?
He's never going to invite me again.
Well, it's been 2 years since you were on the last time, so you know how long it's going to last.
We'll see you sometime around 2020.
You've just finished listening to, what did we listen to?
blooper reel material.
Hi, you just listened to me making a fool of myself.
Thank you for listening to podcast episode.
What?
Can you cut that out?
I don't know, can I?
It's not the question is can he, the question is will he?
No, I think he's obligated to put that up. I don't think there's a choice.
Record date October 23rd, 2010. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.